Member Week is here at Lowe's. That means it's time for MyLowe's Rewards members to save big with up to 40% off hundreds of items like appliances, tools, home essentials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings now through October 15th. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And we're back with a special one for you today. In light of one of our favorite horror franchises, The Conjuring, releasing The Last Rites a couple weeks ago. This has been on the schedule to do another Warren Files.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Been a minute.
And considering everything, but really it's kind of because we were running out. We've like covered so many of the Warren's files.
Yeah, did we count how many we have now? It's got to be almost 20.
Yeah, it has to be at this
rate. Around there.
And yeah. This isn't even really, this is a Warren's file, but it's like, historically, it's a lot of other stuff. And Harry Price also did his own investigation into this one as well.
Right. But the paranormal presence that they supposedly encounter in this particular case is a nun. And it's, from what we know, this case inspired Valak, of course, which we brought Valak out today, right behind Austin.
Beautiful.
In case you don't know who Valak is, Valak the demonic demon, demonic nun, I should say, from the Conjuring series, was inspired by this. James Wan, when he created this character, went straight to the Warren Files for inspiration. So
he got to speak with Lorraine, who had kind of described this entity, and then they had encountered a nun presence related to Borley that we're about to get into. So it's all kind of interconnected. There's some creative liberties taken, but it's all kind of circles back to this nun.
Yeah, so here's the true story behind the nun. This is the haunting of the Borley Rectory and Church, which... Rectory is just a weird word. Like, why do we need to call basically a house, right?
Yeah, I think the only thing that distinguishes it from a house is the fact that it's tied directly to like a parish or a religious institute.
Where the clergy stay.
Yeah, live. Yeah. And it's typically built... I think sometimes they're like apartments.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But sometimes they're just single family homes. But yeah, the rectory.
The rectory. So this is the Borley Rectory, which was built all the way back in 1862 in Borley, Essex, England, just outside of Sudbury. And just across Hall Road, the original nave of the Prayers Church was built in the 11th or 12th century with renovations and additions in the 14th and 16th centuries. It's considered a Grade 1 historic building, which in England, this is the highest grade that they get for it. So this is a very, very old building. This parish served the surrounding rural community of Borley and the surrounding villages. It was kind of the center point of this town in a lot of ways. An earlier rectory, which sat near the church, had been destroyed by a fire in 1841. So this new Gothic-style rectory made of sturdy red brick was built to last for centuries. But unfortunately, it only lasted less than 80 years. The new rectory was originally occupied by the parish rector, Reverend Henry Dawson Ellis Bull, and his wife. The region was once known for its booming wool business, but around the time Reverend Bull and his wife moved in, The wool barons had moved north, leaving Borley as a quiet, isolated agricultural town. Reverend Bull made some additions to the house over the years, including a new wing to make space for his 14 children, which...
That
doesn't even make sense to me. That's...
Getting busy.
Good for him, man.
Yeah.
That's a big family. And the Bull family would occupy the home for the next 60 years. After the additions, the home eventually had 23 rooms connected by 3 staircases, a massive cellar surrounded by 4 acres of wooded land. So, pretty large home.
Yeah.
23 rooms.
Look at this floor plan. Awesome. Here. Like, it has a courtyard in the center of it. Isn't that sweet?
That's sweet. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this layout. Dining room. Look at all those bedrooms.
Man. I know. It's just, you can imagine all the kids like running up and down the hallways.
Big, big house.
Yeah.
But legends tell that a series of stairs and tunnels once ran beneath the rectory and nearby church, but it was never understood what they were used for. Some claim they're only culverts and irrigation channels, but others claim they might have been used for more nefarious purposes.
Ooh.
Wonder what that means.
Hmm.
But during the Bull family stay at the rectory, rumors of supernatural encounters began to spread. And many of these encounters began soon after the rectory's construction, which is kind of interesting. It's believed that the Bull children were the first to tell the original ghost tales of a Benedictine monastery that was built on the grounds in the 1300s when a coachman started a passionate relationship with an Anglican nun. This tale and the following encounters were told by Reverend Bull's daughters, Ethel and Millie Bull, who had experienced years of paranormal encounters at Borley. And the sisters weren't entirely sure about the true history of the nun, but they once believed she might have been a woman named Arabella Waldengrave, and she had gone into exile in France with King James II and took holy orders in Paris. She was eventually forcefully returned to her ancestral home in Borley and placed in a convent against her will. Out of rebellion, she and her new lover, the coachman, would meet in secret in the woods near the convent, often in the dark of night. Eventually, they decided to elope, but their secret was discovered by a group of monks before they could escape. As punishment, they sealed the nun into a hidden room inside the convent and left her to die.
Brutal.
That is an extremely brutal way. And as for the coachman, they captured him, tried him, and then beheaded him for indecency. Hundreds of years after the executions, the Bull family often witnessed the shadow figure of a nun near Borley Rectory. They watched her lurk in the shadows of the trees before fading out of view. Other times, a distant cry could be heard in the dead of night, and it's said she returns to Hall Road on the anniversary of her death. Her phantom waits for her lover to pick her up by coach. And as for that coachman, well, Reverend Bull had once witnessed a driver on a night walk when he heard the sound of horses' hooves along the main road near the rectory. And as he looked to the road, he saw an old-time coach driven by a headless man. The coach was pulled by a pair of phantom horses, and the nun had been waiting for his arrival. The phantom images then disappeared into the night. So that's quite the apparition to see.
Yeah.
Full-blown horse and carriage, headless man. Wow.
Sometimes it was seen as two headless men on it and two headless horses.
Yeah, that's
crazy.
That's intense. The phantom nun was witnessed by 6 members of the Bull family, along with 8 other rectory workers, neighbors, and friends. And sometimes she was even seen inside the rectory as a dark shadow, floating around the rooms or casting her shadow along the walls. A few locals who also lived in the area traveled along Hall Road also reported seeing the nun on several occasions.
After these encounters, Reverend Bull became so obsessed with the paranormal that he ordered for a back porch to be built on the rectory. It would overlook a stretch of property where the nun was often seen, and Reverend Bull would often sit out on the porch after dinner, after sunset, waiting for the nun to appear. Encounters with the paranormal became more and more common at Borley over the years. Not only did phantoms reveal themselves down by Hall Road, but they began appearing closer to the rectory. Guests and rectory staff began complaining of dark, faceless figures staring into the windows on the first floor. Some maids would wake up to find figures of men in top hats at the foot of their bed staring at them. Others witnessed the ghost of an old man, a man in a bowler hat,
a girl in a white or blue dress, a disembodied black hand, and a bizarre-looking insect. It's actually an illustration of this insect, which I can't identify nearly what that looks like.
Yeah, it's like a fly head body of like kind of a worm.
Or like, yeah, a serpent or something.
Yeah, strange.
Reverend Bull would often lose rectory workers over the years due to the haunting encounters. Although rumors suggest that Reverend Bull had inappropriate interactions with the maids, some even leading to violence. One rumor suggested he secretly murdered one of the maids in a fit of rage and hid her body somewhere on the property. He then explained the maid's departure was motivated by the paranormal encounters, but the Bull family would then see the phantom of the maid around the rectory. In 1892, Reverend Henry Bull passed away. His son Harry succeeded his father as the rector of the Borley Parish. It seemed like the paranormal activity died down after his father's passing, but Harry couldn't escape the tormented souls that lingered. One night, he woke up to a figure standing just outside the rectory. At first glance, he thought it was a poacher possibly killing animals on the property, so Harry ran out of the house to chase the man down. But as he found him outside, the man was no more than a pair of legs before he disappeared completely. Reportedly, Harry had narcolepsy, and many of these ghostly impressions would appear to him in a haze right after he regained consciousness. These encounters included faint whispers of disembodied voices, being stalked by humanoid shapes he could only see in his periphery, and the ghost of a screaming girl who he would see falling from the rectory rooftop. Once he even saw Simon of Sudbury, a former Archbishop of Canterbury and Lord Chancellor of England. His phantom would be searching for his lost head before he would disappear. Reverend Harry had several children of his own, and on July 28, 1900, four of his daughters went out to explore the woods. It was only a stone's throw away from the rectory. In the low light beneath the canopy of the woods, they spotted the nun that their aunts had warned of so many times before. Instead of running in fear, the girls tried to speak to the nun, but the phantom vanished into thin air. The Bull family would continue to see the phantom nun over the years, and often she appeared at night, but rarely she could also be seen during the day. The haunted coach, driven by headless coachmen and phantom horses, once veered off Hall Road and approached the home at full speed, only to disappear right before it would crash into the front of the rectory.
So up until this point, only the family, I guess some of the workers there potentially are witnessing the paranormal encounters, but it seems relatively contained to the home.
There's like a few neighbors and friends and stuff who would stop by, but it's more of like a local legend at this rate.
Right. Nobody's come in to vouch for it who has experience with the paranormal or anything like that.
Right.
But Reverend Harry Bull and his family lived at the rectory until his death in the early 1900s, and none of the family members took over as rector, so the family moved, and the house remained vacant for years. Up until then, the paranormal encounters at Borley had only been spread by word of mouth. By 1928, Reverend Eric Smith and his wife took over the homestead after living in India for several years. While abroad, Reverend Smith's health had taken a downturn, so they moved back to England, and they had no children of their own. Upon arrival, Mrs. Smith complained of no central heating, no gas, no electricity, and no main water to the house. The only water came from a well in the yard, so it didn't have all the modern creature comforts yet. And since it had been vacant for years, it had fallen into disrepair. Its rooms were cold and drafty, its roof leaked, and rodents had infested the cellar. The rectory's maid informed the Smiths of the home's haunted history, but the couple just laughed at the tales she told. One morning, while Mrs. Smith cleaned the filthy cupboards to try to make her new home hospitable, she came across a human skull in a brown paper bag. No big deal. It was never made clear who this human skull was, or the identity of it, but its presence alone terrified Mrs. Smith. I think we'd all be pretty terrified if we just found a human skull in a paper bag in a new house we moved into. But after this, the couple began experiencing paranormal phenomena. By this time around, it was more poltergeist activity rather than ghosts or phantoms. The Smiths heard the ringing of servant bells, which was connected to a rope that could be pulled,
setting bells off near the kitchen, but the rope was disconnected years before. They also heard the sound of dragging footsteps in areas where the large home was supposedly empty. Knocking came from within the walls or behind mirrors. They once witnessed a bright light with no electrical source appear in one of the windows and then disappear. Most of their encounters were much different than the Bull's family's encounters, but one was eerily similar. Once Mrs. Smith witnessed the legendary coach on Hall Road, led by two phantom horses, and the nun had also made her regular appearances. Worried about how the paranormal stories at Borley would affect the parish's attendance, the Smiths reached out to the local newspaper, hoping to seek out a paranormal investigator who could take care of this infestation. A reporter, Mr. Wall, eventually got into contact with a psychic researcher from the Society of Psychical Research, or SPR, named Harry Price. His investigation into Borley would make him one of the most famous psychic researchers of the Golden Age of Spiritualism, and he'd even go on to publish a book about Borley in 1940. So with the arrival of Harry Price, word quickly began to spread about Borley and its paranormal occupants. Hordes of curious sightseers came to Borley Rectory. Rather than solving the problem of a haunted reputation, Harry's visit would give Borley the name as the most haunted house in England. With each reported paranormal encounter, Mr. Wall would publish the findings in the daily newspaper beginning in June 1929. The paranormal activity seemed to ramp up compared to the six decades of the Bowles family's occupancy, but after the arrival of Harry Price, a new poltergeist activity plagued the home. Invisible energies hurled candlesticks and vases downstairs or smashed them against the kitchen stove. Other objects like mothballs or pebbles would fly across rooms. Keys shot out of keyholes. Harry Price also noted spiritual messages being tapped into a mirror in the walls. Coincidentally, the poltergeist activity stopped when Harry Price left the home. Mrs. Smith, although she believed there was a paranormal activity within the home, accused Harry of exaggerating and falsifying the encounters for fame and fortune. Ultimately, the events at Borley ended up making Harry Price world famous. But the paranormal activity continued even after Harry Price left. Disembodied footsteps haunted the halls, and the servant bells continued to go off at all hours of the night. And from the paranormal activity and the growing attention from the international media, the Smiths soon found the house to be unbearable to live in. Reverend Smith convinced the local bishop that they should move. So after leaving the rectory for a little more than a year, the Smiths abandoned the house, leaving it vacant for 6 months. Ah, there's that chill in the air. You know what time it is?
Fall time.
It's pumpkin spice latte time.
Ooh, beautiful. I've never had a pumpkin spice latte.
Really? Are you a pumpkin fan? Do you like pumpkin flavored stuff?
I am. And I bet it rocks. I bet it's awesome.
Oh, it does.
I just have never gone out of my way to get it.
Well, next time you're at any coffee shop, I guarantee you they'll have a pumpkin spice something.
Absolutely.
Try it. It's very good. I love fall. I mean, it's my birthday in the fall. It's pumpkin time. It's Halloween. And I love the weather, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And when the weather starts getting colder, it's time to break out the fall clothes, right? You got to get the long sleeves out, get the pants out, just get the cozies out.
Arguably, it's the best time of year for clothing, in my opinion.
Agreed.
You can get the layers going. You can kind of, as at least for guys, you can kind of start switching it up a little bit more. Because what, during summer, it's all we can wear is like a t-shirt.
T-shirts, shorts.
Yeah.
That's it, pretty much.
Sandals.
Yeah, sandals, yeah. That's it. Well, get yourself ready for fall with Quince. They have elevated essentials for this time of year. Think 100% Mongolian cashmere from $50. Also, washable silk tops and skirts. You know how much Austin loves his skirts.
How did you know that's what I do in my private quarters on Friday night?
And now all of you know.
Yeah, now everybody knows.
Cat's out of the bag. All of you out there, you lovely ladies out there, they absolutely have some of the best fall styles, fall clothing out there. My wife, she absolutely loves Quince. She's constantly ordering stuff from there. Everything is top quality. They partner directly with ethical top tier factories and they cut out the middlemen, which gives you luxury quality goods at affordable prices, which is really half the price of some of the similar brands out there. So you're getting good quality clothing, you know, that's made ethically, that's going to last. for a good price. So you can feel good about buying things from Quince.
Yeah, and that's good that Kendall likes it so much, because I'm looking forward to it. I got two things from them. I got a new pair of sneakers, just like Italian leather, but it's kind of like the German trainer style sneakers that I like. I also got this overshirt jacket that I'm looking forward to. So
they have everything.
Yeah, they got everything.
For men, women, baby, kids. If you need a new luggage bag, you need stuff for the home.
Sunglasses.
Yeah. Sheets, jewelry. It's kind of a one-stop shop for all things clothing and home. I mean, they've got everything you need. Keep it classic and cozy this fall with long-lasting staples from Quince. Just go to quince.com/lightsout for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. What about
that?
That's a good return policy.
Wow. That's quince.com/lightsout to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/lightsout. Reverend Lionel Foister, his wife Marianne, and their 2-year-old adopted daughter Adelaide became the next residents of Borley. Reverend Foister was a man in his early 50s who suffered from chronic arthritis. He was well-respected in the Borley community, and he was described as a delightful, typical, cultured person of the best type, a scholar, a Cambridge Master of Arts, and much traveled. Marianne was younger, in her late 30s, and described as an attractive redhead in good health. The psychic researcher Harry Price soon returned to the property for a short time after Reverend Foister began reporting odd occurrences. Marianne ended up kicking him out of the house after he accused her of fabricating the phenomena. From then on, most of the hauntings during the Foister stay were recorded by Reverend Foister in his personal diary. He would later send Harry Price a copy of his manuscript, and Price would publish its contents along with his own investigation under the title The Most Haunted House in England, which would introduce Borley Rectory to the rest of the world. This was that book we mentioned earlier that would be published in, I believe, 1940.
Which, what a title.
Yeah, right.
What a great title to come out with.
Right, yeah. Straight to the point. Bold. And this book would also introduce a young 17-year-old Ed Warren.
Wow.
Yeah, to the haunted rectory while he was still serving in the U.S. Navy. So long before he was even in the game here. The book cataloged a long list of bizarre paranormal interactions. On the Foisters' very first day in the Borley Rectory, the family heard strange footsteps lumbering around the house. They also heard faint whispers saying, "Marianne, dear." Soon the servant bells began ringing again and small pebbles came tumbling down the staircases. Other times the presence was more violent. Now large stones and wine bottles would come crashing down to the floor. One time, a window shattered on a completely still day. Another time, 2-year-old Adelaide was locked inside a bedroom behind a door that didn't have a key or a lock. Her parents frantically tried to yank the door open with no luck. Luckily, eventually, the door was released from this weird supernatural hold. Some of these events were witnessed by neighbors and friends, not just the Foisters. Like always, the Phantom Nun and Coach would also appear near Hall Road. The phenomenon is the only one that has stayed consistent since the construction of the rectory throughout all the families who lived there. Reverend Foister even noted that the ghost of Harry Bull, the deceased rector, also appeared to him.
It seems like anybody who dies on this property is just bound
there. Stuck there, yeah. Absolutely.
Weird that they keep seeing everybody that passes here.
Right.
Still there.
Yep.
Even in death.
And it is interesting that the legend of the nun persists through everybody. They keep seeing her around. The Foisters would also smell these traces of faint perfume that hadn't come from any scent that Marianne owned. And furniture in the various rooms would shift around when no one was looking. Other times, mysterious writings appeared on the walls, but much of it was indecipherable. And the only messages that could be really read said, "Marianne, light mass, prayers," and another one that said, "Marianne, please get help." You can actually take a look at some of these. Sometimes it's written in cursive, sometimes it's in script. But it looks like they also tried to respond to the writing.
Yeah. They've got little messages written back to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, spirits writing. That's one is a tough one for me.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, but I feel like it'd just be very easy for somebody to hoax, but
to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
True.
And like we're dealing with something, you know, an energy. Like an energy has the ability to write a message.
Pick up a pencil.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess
if it can move other stuff, why couldn't it move a pencil? Very strange.
At times, Marianne seemed like the target of the paranormal activity, and for the first time at Borley, the supernatural energy physically attacked one of the residents. In one instance, Marianne was actually thrown from her bed down to the bedroom floor in the middle of the night. Reverend Foister then decided to exorcise the rectory, and he did it two times. And he did it himself, and luckily this actually seemed to relax the supernatural energy for some time, but it eventually began again, and this time in different forms. Their daughter Adelaide seemed to be tortured by some unseen force. She was constantly crying or fussing. I mean, I don't think that's too bizarre for a two-year-old.
Yeah, I don't know if I would attribute that to ghost activity or not.
You would know more than the rest of us, right?
Kids do a lot of crying and fussing.
Yeah.
On their own.
Right.
Unprovoked.
Right. Other times, the Foisters would hear mysterious music from the parish across the street. I know it had a big organ installed to it at some point, so the
Da-da-da.
Organ would just start going off. Even when they knew that the parish was completely empty. And one time, they noticed the communion wine had somehow turned into black ink. So we'll get more into this. This is the first time we're actually touching on the Borley Parish being haunted, because we've mostly just been in the rectory, but it kind of would leak over into the parish over the years. So we'll get more into that later. But in Reverend Foister's diary, he also told of a recurrent visitor, a young World War I veteran by the name of Edwin Whitehouse. He had reportedly suffered from PTSD, or they called it shell shock back then, and the Reverend mentioned that Edwin was often in an emotional and nervous state whenever he was at the rectory, which I know we've kind of touched on this theory. It's often in a Warren's File episode, we notice that the people who are in these kind of emotionally distraught states are the targets of specifically more poltergeist activity, but sometimes just haunting activity in general. So this Edwin had come to the Reverend seeking spiritual help, hoping that it would heal his mental ailments. So he and the Reverend often spoke at the rectory, and Edwin would later decide to join the Benedictine community of monks. But during this time of indecision, when he was emotionally distraught, he had stayed with the Foisters in the rectory for a while, and he soon became the target of many of the paranormal phenomena. Poltergeist activity increased during this time, and objects would fly at him or around him, and Edwin's name would even appear in the mysterious wall writing, again in cursive, but a bit more legible this time around. Meanwhile, Marianne Foister had become bored while living in the Borley countryside, which is kind of surprising that you'd be bored in a house with this much activity going on.
Yeah, you're seeing literal apparitions or phantoms, like...
Right. But, you know, her husband was spending a lot of time speaking with Edwin, trying to get him help. So she began taking these trips to London, and she eventually started a flower shop business with a man named Mr. Darrell. She also began looking after the man's son, whom she took back to Borley to watch after him. She also reportedly adopted children from the local Church of England Children's Society. Which, if we didn't clarify this, the parish is Church of England. It's an Anglican church, and I believe this Church of England Children's Society was some sort of program that helped people adopt children. But people started to notice that many other babies and toddlers began appearing at Borley. So no longer ghosts are showing up here, just random,
a lot of kids,
random children. So rumors actually began to spread that Marianne was engaging in what's known as baby farming, where she would accept infants in exchange for money, because in the 1930s, it was seen as socially unacceptable to have a child out of wedlock. So many people were trying to just give away their children, and adoption centers were often over capacity, so they would just find women and be like, look, I'll pay you a lump sum if you can just take my child from me. So people think that she was taking these children for money, and adoption laws were pretty loose back then. So many assumed Marianne was just engaging in this baby farming for some extra cash, but possibly also out of sheer boredom because she didn't have much to do around there. Many rumors, I mean, also I can kind of imagine you're in the middle of this agricultural town, nothing to do. Your husband's 20 years older than you. He's got arthritis and he's too busy doing the rectory work or doing the parish work.
What else is there to do?
Yeah, I can see why it would get boring. And they only had one young adopted child. So I don't know, maybe she just felt like she could become a mother figure to a needy child.
What else do you do with 23 rooms?
Yeah, right.
You got a lot of room.
That must be really also kind of scary with the house that empty.
Yeah. Quiet, creepy.
Yeah. So a lot of rumors beyond that paranormal activity around Borley began to spread, mostly around Marianne. And Marianne eventually just loathed all the villagers there. It seemed like she quickly became an outcast. But years passed, and by 1935, Reverend Foister had fallen into poor health. He was mostly immobile and could no longer serve the parish, so the Foisters left the rectory. And Reverend Lionel Foister later died of quote-unquote arthritic complaint in 1945 at 67 years old.
But while the property sat vacant again, no church members wanted to live in Borley Rectory. So after it sat empty for 2 years, Harry Price gathered a team of investigators to rummage through the property and conduct an investigation. He actually took over the lease in 1937 for about a year and a half and was excited to finally investigate the property without any interruptions from occupants. Put out an ad in the local newspaper to hire paranormal investigators to monitor the house all day and night. His team was made up of 48 people in total.
That's a huge operation.
Yeah, that is a lot of people. 48?
Everyone gets their own bedroom.
There you go. Bunk bed in each, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Before the investigation, Harry Price created a DIY guide for his team that taught them how to respond to and how to take note of paranormal phenomena. He called it the Blue Book. Many of his team reported trivial sounds, but some of the reports could be tracked with tools and instruments. Many noticed drastic temperature shifts in different areas of the building. They also set up a stack of books connected to a device that would detect movement, and if movement was detected, then a bell would sound. That bell did go off, but some doubted if it was poltergeist activity or a cat that had snuck into the house. I mean, the house was vacant for 2 years, so there's probably lots of critters in there.
Yeah, rodents.
But who knows? Others witnessed coats without visible bodies gliding around the house or objects being thrown by invisible forces. Some of the lead investigators also performed seances to attempt to contact any spirits that were within the rectory. They did not use a Ouija board, but instead they used a table similar to the famous Philip experiment in the 1970s. They also asked mostly yes or no questions, or questions that could be answered with one word. And there's even a screenshot of some of the questions.
Yeah, they were trying to get information for, like, what the spirit was that they were talking to.
Who are you? Are you happy?
Yep.
What caused your unhappiness? During this conversation, who are you, Henry? Are you happy? No. Who caused your unhappiness? Uncertain, but apparently my wife. Of course, his wife.
So that might be Henry Bull, possibly, from the first rector.
The transcript of the interaction was later given to a woman named Helen Glanville, who then used a planchette and Ouija board to communicate with the spirits further. She made contact with two spirits, and she claimed that the nun, who was often seen at the property, had the name Mary, or Marie Lair. And her story was similar to the other stories that had been passed down from the Bull family. The spirit said she had been murdered and buried in the cellar, and the spirit also claimed responsibility for the writing on the walls aimed at Marianne Foister. The second spirit claimed to be Sunex Ahmyers, who threatened to burn the rectory down. They also mentioned that after the fire, human remains could be found in the ruins. After Harry Price's investigation, the property was bought by a man known as Captain W.H. Gregson. He made some money off the property by giving haunted tours, and he claimed that his dogs mysteriously disappeared when he brought them to the rectory. And not long after, the house actually mysteriously caught fire, ending in a total loss at midnight on February 27, 1939. This is when it went up in flames. Allegedly, Captain Gregson was unpacking boxes when he knocked over an oil lamp in the hallway. The blaze spread quickly, engulfing the entire home in flames. It was later discovered that Captain Gregson owned many properties that, quote-unquote, mysteriously caught fire, and some suspected him of committing arson in order to collect on the insurance money, which that was a very common scam back then.
And also his story, like, okay, you're unpacking boxes, you knock over an oil lamp.
Oops!
And that single oil lamp catches this massive house on fire. That
no attempts to put it out, clearly.
Yeah, what? You just throw a blanket on it and you're good.
It's like, oh, bummer.
Yeah.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Skyline's new chicken chili is here. Now you can enjoy that legendary Skyline taste with a new protein option. Try Skyline's chicken chili on Waze, Coney's, and all your Skyline favorites. Feeling good. It's Skyline time.
Others believe the fire was indirectly caused by Amiras, the spirit that had threatened to burn the place down and reveal human remains. Witnesses to the massive house fire claim to have seen figures walking within the house. Some also claim they saw the nun peering through a second-story window. The ruins of the rectory then crumbled over the years. The rubble was removed in 1944, and Harry Price attended the final demolition. He claimed that he saw a brick levitate in mid-air. Damn. Reportedly, the area where the rectory once stood still has a massive cellar, subterranean tunnels, and waterways. After the demolition of the remains, many submitted their own theories to Harry Price. Others dug into the history looking for clues on the mysterious phantom nun. No records of a monastery or a convent were found in Borley, but some noted that these religious buildings had once existed several miles away. Apparently, Harry Price found two human bones on the property after the demolition of the ruins. He believed they belonged to a woman, and many believe they were the remains of the notorious spectral nun, and they were later buried in a cemetery in Liston. Borley Parish refused to give the bones a Christian burial on their property because they believe that the bones actually belong to a pig and not a human. That's a pretty big confusion there.
Right.
Pig bones, human bones.
Yeah. I don't know.
How come the human bones weren't given to the authorities?
That's another
When you find
question.
Human remains, you usually just report it to the authorities.
I know. That was also why I was confused with the human skull being found in the kitchen, because we don't.
Right.
Whatever happened with that one. Maybe that was a part of the
Is
remains.
Is that the nun's skull?
Yeah, who knows? But after the rectory was long gone, its paranormal legends still circulated, and the BBC even ran a TV series on the rectory after World War II. Since it was difficult to travel around Britain after the war because of the destruction, as well as the mines and barbed wire that riddled the coasts, many could travel to quiet places like Borley, that place was generally unaffected by the war. So for years, many came to Borley hoping to find a piece of this paranormal puzzle. Between 1947 and 1953, the Borley Rectory became a household name in Great Britain. People held seances on the property, parapsychologists gave lectures about the property, and the countless newspaper articles really pushed this story of Borley and its haunting. On March 24, 1948, the psychic researcher Harry Price passed away from a heart attack. The same year, a writer for the Daily Mail, Charles Sutton, wrote an article accusing Harry of fabricating the paranormal phenomena at Borley when he had joined him at the rectory back in 1929. Apparently, during this visit, Charles had been hit on the head with a large stone, which was similar to a lot of the other poltergeist activity going on then, but Charles wasn't as gullible as Harry Price thought he was. According to Charles, he had found a stash of stones that Harry had hidden from the rest, and the stone that hit his head had matched the others in that collection. Then three members of the Society for Psychical Research also accused Harry Price of fraud in the book The Haunting of Borley Rectory. If you remember, the Society of Psychical Research was the same organization that Harry Price was a part of. And two of the authors were actually at the rectory when Harry Price had conducted his year-long investigation, year and a half. They concluded that the majority of the investigation's findings were fraudulent. Other skeptics claimed that the other occurrences were either natural, like rodents moving things around, and that the noises came from the old house shifting around. They also noticed that the paranormal occurrences always surged when Marianne Foister or Harry Price were around. But Harry Price actually still had some colleagues who defended him, and Robert Hastings, an American ufologist, was one of the few SPR researchers to defend Price and his work. Harry's literary executors also defended Price against accusations of fraud, which, I mean, of course they did, because they're kind of tied to the work. So if he's fraudulent, they're fraudulent. But fellow investigator and author Peter Underwood called the SPR's report a biased and uncharitable attack not consistent with the evidence.
So it seems uncharitable.
Like, yeah, I like that.
That's like that.
And I hear that in the British accent,
yeah,
too.
Uncharitable yeah. attack.
But it is interesting that there's some infighting here.
Yeah.
People really can't, there's not a resounding, yes, this is fraudulent, or no, it's real. But others like Terrence Hines, a professor of psychology at Pace University who studied the paranormal events at Borley, wrote this: Marianne Foister was actively engaged in fraudulently creating the phenomena. Price himself salted the mine and faked several phenomena while he was at the rectory. Marianne Foister even later claimed that she did not witness any paranormal events at the house, which is odd. She said the noises were just caused by the wind, and other times she and her visitors were playing practical jokes on her husband, the older rector, if you remember. She also then admitted to having an affair with a man who stayed with them, a man named Frank Peerless. She used the excuse of helping with the paranormal investigation so she could just go and be with Frank. Which is crazy.
What is going on here? I'm seeing like a reality show playing
out
here. I know.
And why would she admit this?
That's so weird.
I mean, I guess like her husband had already passed away from the what did they call it?
But she can only get his attention if he's investigating the paranormal activity at her house.
Right? I don't understand
like, what?
That.
And like some of this other stuff could just be, you know, an academic, you know, psychology, psychologist, professor, whatever, clashing with like a paranormal researcher, you know, at the time.
Oh,
like,
yeah. It's know. Almost like beef.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's kind of like, put me on the
you don't know what you're
bit.
Talking about. Yeah. You're not educated. Well, I study this stuff. Because, I mean, we're talking about a ufologist too.
True, yeah.
You know, anybody who works at any sort of college or university is probably not going to
agree with
it, yeah. what a ufologist says.
Yeah.
Typical beef.
Yep. Reverend Eric Smith's wife, who lived at the property for about a year and reported paranormal activity then, also later wrote to the Church Times and the Daily Mail, saying that neither she nor her husband, Reverend Eric Smith, believed that Borley was haunted, which is even stranger because I think that was the first couple who called Harry Price in to investigate because they were worried that the hauntings and the rumors would affect the parish.
Yeah, well, and I'm just like, aren't these religious folks? If they really are having a haunting going on, why don't they know how to get rid of the devil? Get rid of
exercise
demons?
These
yeah.
boys.
It's like, why would they even allow this to go on?
Yeah, I think the only person who exercised the house was Foister, Reverend Foister. He was the one that did it twice. But yeah, everyone else was like, what do we do?
Because like, I mean, I'm not super familiar with Anglican beliefs, but I would assume that they would think any sort of spectral nun or apparition would be demonic in nature, right?
Right, yeah. And I know they don't have like the same exorcist rules
as
like the Catholic Church does. I don't know how they really handle, how do Anglicans handle demonic entities if they think that they're demonic?
Oh, so they have a very similar way of sort of dealing with it as the Catholic Church.
Oh, okay.
Anglican churches address suspected demonic activity through a formal
bishop-approved process known as deliverance ministry.
Oh, so it's basically just a different name.
Yeah.
All right.
So it's the same type of thing. Contact a parish priest, referral to the bishop's team, multidisciplinary assessment. So they have a process.
So why were the
reverends... So what's going on here? Where'd Harry Price come from?
Yeah, and why...
Harry's like, yeah.
Yeah, let's make some money. But why didn't any of the reverends reach out to the bishop?
They literally have a whole ministry. If the team determines that spiritual affliction is present, interventions can range from pastoral care to a formal rite of exorcism.
That's why it seems
like... And
we're
talking about the pastors.
Right, yeah.
The priests, the people that run the rectory.
That's why I'm wondering if Harry Price had maybe something to do with maybe the stories at play here. But, I mean, according to him and the books that he published, it was Reverend Foister's diary. Like he was like recording everything that was happening. It was coming from a reverend, so... I don't know.
Do we just have some really cool Anglicans that are open-minded to the paranormal? Yeah, like, what's going on
here?
Let's
hang out. Yeah.
Because this seems like they would have escalated this. They would have brought in, you know, their superiors or people that they gain wisdom and advice from and gotten help that way spiritually.
Especially if they were thinking that it was affecting the numbers at the parish, like the attendees, the congregation. Wouldn't they want to go to the bishop? Like, hey, we have this weird situation out here.
Yeah.
Maybe they did. Maybe they did. It just wasn't recorded. I don't know.
They tried to exercise it themselves and didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
But this part is a bit weird. In 2000, so many, many years later, Louis Mayerling, who had apparently lived at Borley for a time, because often we forget that there were I don't know if this is PC, servants. Can we say servants?
Yeah.
House servants, is that okay?
Yeah.
So we often forget. I mean, when you think about this whole story going back, it's important to remember that there were a lot of house servants in the rectory working during this time who were familiar with what was kind of going on.
It's not like they managed the house themselves.
Right, exactly. And especially when you have so many, like what the first family had, like 14 children. So
house gets messy.
Yeah.
A lot of meals, a lot of laundry.
Exactly.
Then you have the acreage property that needs to be tended to.
Yeah.
So you need a lot of manpower.
Yeah.
Too.
And considering you don't have running water and like all those.
Got to bring all that in. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of work to be done. So with that, Louis Mayerling, he claimed that he was hired by the rector's family, which he doesn't really specify which family, to wear a costume and wander the grounds at night. He also explained that much of the other phenomena was created by other servants and the children who had access to secret doors and passageways throughout the house. He also said the knocking sounds may have been caused by a noisy water heater. But that I couldn't find any record of them eventually getting plumbing to this house. Because remember, it didn't.
Yeah,
it just had a well in the yard. So this guy's saying that there was a water heater there, which wouldn't make sense.
Where they
wasn't plumbing
go to the bathroom?
Yeah,
in the outhouse.
Is there a latrine?
Yeah,
I want to hear more about that latrine.
Yeah, what's going on?
That
here?
Thing was definitely haunted. If it wasn't, even if there wasn't any paranormal stuff going on,
14 kids using one bathroom.
Oh man. Yeah. So I don't know if,
what is this? Where does this guy come from in 2000? Like, yeah, I was paid to wear a costume. A scream mask and walk around the yard? Like,
right.
What are you talking about?
Was he trying to say it was like, I was the nun maybe? I don't know. And also 2000, man, this story is kind of out of the zeitgeist by 2000.
This started in like the 20s, bro. It's been almost a century since.
Well, it was built in 1860 or something.
Yeah.
So a bit late to the game here, Louis. But you know, all of this considered, the kind of the back and forth, the skepticism, the people pointing fingers, even the people admitting that, hey, we kind of lied about some of this stuff. This ultimately left many to speculate on what actually happened at the Borley Rectory, and many questions whose accounts could be trusted and whose couldn't. And it might be one of these cases where we often see where it's like there could be a nugget of truth somewhere baked into this, but then you get other people getting their hands
piling
on the
legend, right?
Yeah, and just saying stuff, right?
Yeah, that's the really, it's difficult to separate the facts from the fiction, you know, from the, you know, because it's like if you move into a place that's supposedly haunted, are you more apt to have a paranormal experience there? When if you didn't know it was haunted,
right,
would you just think, oh, that's the hot water heater, oh, that's a mouse running through the walls? In my own house, in my office, from time to time, I hear a knocking on my wall. And my first thought was, Josh, the spirit from the studio follows you home.
Oh, man.
But then I sat there and I listened to it. And then it happens like all the time. And I was like, oh, what is that? Simple Google search. Hey, I'm hearing knocking in my walls. And it was like, well, it's either a rodent or it's your HVAC. And sure enough, I look over at my wall and I look down and there's an intake vent for the HVAC system. And so, apparently, just having the HVAC system on in that particular, I guess, piping in the wall.
Was it like flexing the metal?
Yeah, it's just flexing and like tapping against the wall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it does it like... It sounds like somebody's knocking on the door. Like,
that's funny.
And I always look up and look over at the door, and my dogs are always like think somebody's at the door. But no, it's just knocking in the walls. But if I didn't, if my house was sold to me as a haunted house, and I didn't have Google,
yeah,
I might
you'd be
think
like, that's a ghost.
Yeah, I'd be like, there is something, you know, knocking. So it's like, and it's interesting too because a while back on my other show, Mile Higher, I had a paranormal researcher come on. And his name was Brian. He was just like a local Denver paranormal researcher. And he was very interesting because he's investigated tons of places all around Denver. And he was like, you would actually be surprised at how many paranormal investigations I've done where people are claiming all sorts of things. And I get in there and it's something very, very simple and ordinary
that's actually
causing it. And he was actually able to get it to replicate it. And then show the owner, hey, actually it's this, or it's it's a wire, it's this, or it's weird. There's so many normal things that can cause weird disturbances and experiences that you maybe have never had before, or didn't even know were possible for like a wire to do that or something, or an HVAC system to make those noises.
Sure.
But if you're hell bent on this is a haunted location.
Yeah.
It's going to lean that way.
It's the preconceived notions, right? I think we do that with a lot of stuff, not even just haunted house.
Yeah.
If you go into a movie thinking it's going to be crap, the movie's going to be crap, right? Because
you've already set the expectations for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Or it's going to be the greatest movie you've ever seen because you set your expectations so low. So I think we do that with a lot of things, and paranormal events are no different.
Not to say that paranormal events aren't real. I think they are. I think it's just, they're very hard to discern, and you have to almost investigate it like a scientist would.
Right. Yeah.
You have to use like the scientific method.
And the tools.
And the right tools to actually determine it.
Right. And I know like with the worker who was saying he was going up putting on a costume and like going messing with people, I can relate to that because if I knew that there was a spectral nun that was reported at this property, you bet your ass I would be getting a nun outfit. And knowing the 14 kids lived at this house, I would be out in the woods, like creeping around in a nun outfit to get everyone geeked about it. So I don't know. Even then, it's still kind of wild to me that throughout generations, people kept seeing this nun. So it wasn't just some guy in a costume or anything like that. It's could you write that up as mass hysteria? Is that more of preconceived notions? They're like, we know the nun is out there, so you kind of see what you want to see. I don't know.
Was the rectory ever inspected?
Right.
For, you know what I mean? It's those types of things, those steps that usually aren't taken in paranormal stories.
Yeah.
Before we just say, oh yeah, that's definitely a real paranormal
case.
Right.
Where you rarely hear, yes, we brought a home inspector in. I've got some great home inspectors that do really get in there.
Yeah.
And they'll find something that's causing a noise or a stench or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sometimes easy, especially in older properties, to jump to.
Yeah. My, so I had a 100-year-old house in Hamtramck, and the heater system was as old. So like right when radiators kind of fell out of style, it was the largest furnace you've ever seen in your life. And they actually had to cut it in half to get it out of my house, because I replaced it right before I sold the place with a new one. But I was like, damn, this thing, it was really inefficient heater, but it had lasted for so long. The guy who inspected it said it was maybe like an 80-year-old plus heater.
Wow.
It's like one of the first heaters ever installed in a house.
Wow.
And I remember that thing would flex.
Would it use oil?
I remember the pilot light, when the thing would light, it was like.
So you actually have like a whole
like
lit thing you could see.
It was massive, and it sounded like a roaring flame would turn on when that thing kicked on. Yeah.
It's like the furnace from Home Alone.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Like when the furnace kicks on, it makes this weird noise.
Right, yeah. So.
Or no, Elf too.
That was it. Yeah, yeah.
Or the radiator. Turns
those are radiators.
It's like it's making a weird sound.
Yeah, yeah. Both of those had radiator horrors. But yeah, that furnace was massive.
Yeah.
But I remember I would hear a really loud like, poo, that would kind of echo through my house sometimes. And I realized it was actually, I would go down there and wait for the furnace to kick on. And it was actually the metal was flexing.
From the heat.
Yeah. So I always wondered, I was like, what the hell is that? Also, of all houses to be haunted, the 100-year-old house might be one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just ended up being the furnace. Kind of a boring answer, but.
Well, you never know. You just never know with these old cases. But it's still, so the rectory, we're kind of on the fence, right? We're on the fence of whether or not anything paranormal was actually happening there.
Sure.
Seems like it's possible, but there's a lot of questions still.
And there's a lot of maybe people associated with this.
Harry kind of fucked it up for me a little bit.
Yeah, you can't trust him after a while.
He went
full
blown to go and be like, this is the most paranormal heavy house in England.
Yeah, yeah.
Says a lot, right? Because like, what is that? It's shock and awe. It's like, oh, you're not going to believe this. He could have just been like, you know, the paranormal happenings of the Borley Rectory.
Yeah.
So it's like he's trying to sell it, right? He's got a motive to sell books here.
Absolutely. I'm sure it might be kind of rough financially to be a psychic researcher in these days. So he's got to make some money too, you know?
But that doesn't mean the parish itself, the Borley Parish across the street, doesn't have something going on, because we're now going to get into where Ed and Lorraine Warren kind of get involved here, because despite the criticism, many still believed that Borley was haunted. In 1955, Thurston Hopkins, a British photojournalist, visited the property where the rectory once stood. The building was gone, but the gateway near Hall Road was still standing. He arrived on a calm, sunny day in mid-afternoon. He wanted to get a picture of the gatepost and fence against the sky. Later, when he developed the film, he noticed a black shadow in the center of the photo. Some had claimed that the nun had once appeared to them as a black shadow. Thurston Hopkins was certain that the shadow was not visible in his viewfinder when he first took the picture.
I tried to scrape the bottom of the internet to find this picture. I couldn't. So if anyone out there can possibly find this photo, I would be very thankful.
Well, it sounds like there's not much of a photo.
It's just a black blob
on the screen.
Yeah.
Which,
still kind of interesting. If he didn't see it in the viewfinder when he took it, what? That's an anomaly of some kind.
And again, we got to take his word for it, right?
Right.
Yeah, he didn't see it.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
But again, it's possible this demonic entity, it seems, is still floating around the Borley Parish. So tales of the Phantom Nun continued through the years, eventually getting the interest of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Because Ed, he already knew about this place.
Mm-hmm.
From a long, you know,
17 years old.
So Ed Warren, you know him, we know him, and you know all the parts of his story.
True.
Right? Which we don't forget. Ed, of course, self-proclaimed demonologist. Lorraine, clairvoyant, and a medium. and they worked together as a married couple for about 50 years. And in their career, they claim to have investigated over 10,000 cases. We're at like almost 20 and we're running out.
Yeah, so where are the rest of those cases?
Release the Warren files, please. Like, you know, along with those other files that we want to see too, but definitely want to see the Warren files because there's 10,000 cases. Where's all that info?
I know.
And evidence.
Even with this case, I was like, they claim to have all this footage and stuff, and it's nowhere.
It's being held under lock and key
in
by
the museum.
Tony Spera. Well, the museum's sold.
Oh, that's right.
Matt Rife owns it now, which that'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. But
Matt Rife, release the files, man.
Does he have possession of the investigation materials or just
the building? I would assume it's just the building.
I think Tony Spera still has. He still, I believe, has all of like the actual investigative files, I would assume. Unless he sold that. I don't know. I'm curious of how that whole deal went down.
Yeah. Yes.
How did Matt Rife, out of all people, end up purchasing this?
And why?
And why? Well, I know why. Money.
Money.
Because guess
always.
What? New Airbnb, baby.
Oh, my God. Yeah, seriously.
Bed and breakfast at the Warren's house.
God, yeah, that's what it's going to turn into.
Which I don't know how they're going to do that. How? Because I guarantee that house is zoned for residential. It's in the middle of like a quiet neighborhood.
True, yeah.
So I don't know how he's going to pull that off, but maybe he can do like a short-term rental Airbnb. There's no way he can have like a full-blown museum there.
No. God.
What I could see him doing is moving all of the museum artifacts to another location.
Sure.
And then having like their house be an Airbnb.
Okay.
For people to stay in. Because you can do that in a residential neighborhood.
Okay. That would make more sense. So, could you imagine moving all that stuff too?
It looks like they did just sell the building to Matt Rife.
Okay, good.
They Tony and Judy Spera still own all of the artifacts and everything, and there's a 5-year plan to where after that 5-year lease is up, they're going to move the artifacts to an actual museum. So this is only a temporary thing.
Wait, Matt didn't get the artifacts? I thought he was the new, was that misreported? He's not the new owner of Annabelle?
I think he is, maybe Annabelle, but from what I'm reading right here, it says that he only bought the building and they're leasing the artifacts to him for 5 years.
Oh, interesting. That was misreported. He is not the legal guardian of the Annabelle doll.
So just leased. Sounds like the Sparas need some money then.
So he just bought the building. Well, he sure made it seem like he was about to own the whole museum.
So you said he gets to lease the stuff for 5 years. Did that include Annabelle?
Yes. So Matt Rife became its
legal guardian.
Legal guardian in 2025 as a part of a 5-year agreement.
Oh, he made it sound. Oh, dude, he milked that. He made it sound like he owned all of it.
I just think he's not that funny. But
I agree. I don't find him funny at all.
I don't either.
I think he's got not a whole lot going for him.
No. That's why
he's got Annabelle for 5 years.
Seems like he's taking a new career path here since he couldn't make it in comedy.
He's going to have a Zach Bagans
special.
Yeah,
maybe he's looking to take over for Zach Bagans. So, all right, legal guardian. Excuse me.
I don't like how
that's
they
weird.
Say legal guardian.
Yeah,
I don't
over
like
a
that.
Doll? Yeah. The hell? Yeah. So that's weird. But anyways, back to the Warrens. Forget about Matt Rife. Probably sound like a bunch of haters over here.
Yeah, we do.
Matt Rife sucks.
Sorry, guys. Sorry, all the Rife fans out there.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Well, the Warrens, they went and visited Borley several times in the 1970s, and they'd go every year on their anniversary for decades.
Isn't that hilarious?
Date night.
Yeah, we're going, baby.
Borley Rectory.
Haunted parish.
And although the infamous rectory is, of course, gone, all the rubble's gone, they always visited the Borley Church across the street, which still stands today. It has a chancel, nave, south porch, and crenellated western tower containing three bells. These old churches, there's something about them.
Yeah, it's very modest, but also kind of extravagant too at the same time.
I like old churches. I'm a fan of old churches. I think there's something more spiritual about them than these mega Walmart buildings.
Right. Yeah. Oh my God.
Churches that
soulless.
There's no character and they just like stick a cross on it. And I'm like,
people are like suspended on wires and stuff. It's insane.
It's like some Righteous Gemstones. It's like going to your local arena for a concert every Sunday.
Yeah. No, I like these smaller ones. And I like the idea that, you know, back then this was communal, right?
Yeah.
This was everyone in the area. This is kind of how you came together and just chatted with your neighbors, was just to come to church like this.
It was just the community gathering.
Yeah.
Everybody comes together. You know, you have lunch after with everybody, you talk, you mingle. It's like the social spot.
Yeah, and this is where you found your wife and had 14 kids.
Exactly. I get it. There's charm to it, you know?
Yeah.
I get why the Warrens would want to go there.
Yeah, and it had this old organ in there too.
Yeah,
which is
that's
really cool.
You don't see those anymore.
Installed into the building.
Yeah. God. I went to a few churches that had organs, and then I started going to all the like mega modern churches, and it was like, am I at a concert? At Warp Tour, or am I at a church right now? Yeah. What is going on?
People are screaming.
Yeah,
and stuff.
It's like, oh my God. Just give me a good old fashioned organ, some good old fashioned hymns.
Yeah.
And let's stand at a pew.
Yep. Yeah. We had, growing up, that was it for me, right?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that about Catholic churches, that they respect tradition.
Yeah, it was a lot of tradition. And then I remember when I was growing up a little bit, they started doing this thing called Teen Mass, where they implemented a live band there. And they still did the hymns.
Yeah.
They didn't just go
the
balls to the wall. And it was cool. They had some jazz musicians and stuff. And it was nice. But I remember Monsignor Easton, he was pissed. He was like, I cannot believe we're having
it's like
a band
defiling
here.
The church. Yeah,
right. So they only did it once a week. But funny enough, that was like the busiest church time.
People were like,
during that one mass. It was like, I can't remember, was it Sundays at 6 p.m., I think, was their teen mass. And that's when everyone showed up.
It was like, everybody's like heads are bopping.
We
love that. The Warrens believe that the flint within the Borley Parish's building materials acted as an amplification for transmissions of supernatural frequencies, which is very similar to the stone tape theory, which I really like this theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of all the paranormal theories that sort of explains the phenomenon, the stone tape theory, I feel like, makes a lot of sense.
It's at least kind of trying to approach it as a scientific theory.
Right.
It's like these materials can somehow trap
energies,
memories or time periods or energies of a certain time period. It's cool.
And it sort of replays it like a tape.
You're right.
That's very interesting. We're going to play this clip, although forewarning, if it doesn't end up in the episodes, because Tony Spera has copyrighted it.
Yeah.
But we're going to see if we can sneak it in there. But this is Ed and Lorraine Warren, Lorraine specifically, talking about their experience, their first one at the Borley Parish.
The first experience for me was phenomenal. It was really phenomenal. It's about the only place, Tony, other than going into a home where poltergeist activity is prominent, that everything happens as soon as you get involved. As soon as you walk in, as soon as you get involved in going into this church and beginning your research, something is bound to happen. Now, that first day, I had a very skeptical researcher with me. Mm-hmm. He was a newspaper man from Danbury, and he was obnoxiously skeptical. But he was keeping a full diary for me, so he was very, very helpful. I worried about what his effect was going to have on this building. So I was in and I was discerning. I was standing down by the altar. I was with a group of people and I was discerning when all of a sudden he came charging in through the back door. And he said, "Something is hitting me. It's hitting me. It's hitting me." And he was absolutely hysterical. He was hysterical. Now, at that point, he said, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe."
Now, Lorraine, was this researcher psychic by any chance?
No, he wasn't by psychic. No means. Oh, by
yeah,
no.
He had never been in a haunted area.
He had never been to a haunted area, Tony.
Okay.
And the recorders are on because people are recording what I'm discerning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later at our hotel in London, he came down to my room and said, "Mrs. Warren, it's going to be impossible for me to write anything about that church that we were in." I said, "Borley?" He said, "Yes." He said, "The tape that you gave me where you were discerning,"
mm-hmm.
he said, "you can hear when I come in the room, and I'd like to play it for you." Now, when he, or into the church. Now, when he walked in, and he was yelling like that, a voice, a woman's voice, as he said, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," said, hit him, almost
really?
In a healing way. And you hear her very gentle voice.
Now, this is a spirit voice that she's talking about.
Well, that's quite a first encounter
first
there.
First day?
First day on location at a haunted.
Matt Rife, release that tape.
Yeah, let's hear it. I want to hear this. Something's hitting me. I want to hear
and
that.
And you hear a woman's voice who wasn't there saying something?
Right. Yeah, we want to hear it. That's wild, though.
Yeah.
But later, they heard one of the church bells ring at night. But when the vicar ran to the base of the bell tower, the bell rope was still swinging, but no one else was around. Just ringing on its own. In a different area, Lorraine also witnessed stones falling on the slate floor in front of her. She described these as apports that would dematerialize in one location and then materialize somewhere else. Lorraine said she took the stones and stored them in their famous museum. Interesting. On another night, Lorraine was speaking to her friend and psychic photographer, Rosemary, around 2 or 3 a.m., and as Rosemary spoke, it sounded like someone else was speaking, but no one else was there. As Lorraine approached the altar, she felt the presence of someone directly in front of her. When she closed her eyes, she could see the figure of a monk with his hood up, reading a large book. No one else could see him, but Lorraine could see him clairvisually. Ed also claimed to see bioluminescence in the form of a nun while inside the church. It came floating up the center aisle toward the altar where Lorraine was standing. The Warrens also encountered the infamous nun outside of Borley. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, this nun may have been what led to the inspiration of the demonic nun, Valak, in the Conjuring franchise. I think it's very obvious that this is where the inspiration came from. According to the director of several of the Conjuring movies, James Wan, Lorraine told him about a similar spectral entity that she had seen inside her home, and she described it as a swirling tornado vortex with this hooded figure. This entity would later be portrayed as Valak, a demon in the Conjuring movies, and he disguised himself as a nun, which was a creative decision made by James Wan, which I like. I like this idea.
Making a Catholic.
Yeah, there we go. This nun first appeared in The Conjuring 2 and would later be the focus of the movie The Nun. And there's The Nun 2 now, of course. He appears as a nun with a pale face, black lips, sharp teeth, and yellow glowing eyes. I love this painting that I got of Valak. It's usually sitting over on the other side of the studio here. But it's what greets us when we walk in.
Yeah, and apparently, you know, this was inspired by Ed was a big painter.
Right.
And he would sometimes paint what they would see. And so it's like loosely based off an actual painting that Ed did of a like demonic looking nun. And so that this was like the movie adaptation of that painting, which is interesting. But I'm glad Valak's back. He makes me look really good on camera, side by side.
Yeah, I really like the Valak character.
Do you remember the first sequence with Valak? I think it's The Conjuring 2. It's where I think it's Lorraine is like upstairs in the Enfield house.
Oh.
I could be wrong. Or they're either back at their house. I can't remember. But Lorraine's there and it's like this shadow that moves along this wall and there's a picture hanging on the wall and the shadow kind of like molds into the painting.
Yeah.
Like kind of comes out.
Yeah.
It's really cool, actually.
That, yeah, I like how they incorporated the nun and the Conjuring too.
Yeah. And that sequence was like pretty chilling.
Yeah.
I thought that was one of the coolest shot things in that movie.
Which I wonder if the nun makes an appearance in The Last Rites. I think Valak does appear one more time.
I mean, they should milk that.
Yeah.
How scary Valak looks. I get if they keep milking it.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
So Valak, like just talking about this fictional character in the Conjuring series, actually comes from a medieval grimoire titled The Greater Key of Solomon. And in the book, Valak appeareth like a boy with angel's wings riding on a two-headed dragon.
Wow.
And his special power, according to the text, was finding snakes and hidden treasures while also leading an army of 30 demons.
Hell yeah.
It's kind of badass, honestly. This book was later listed in the Catholic Church's Index Librorum Prohibitorum, a list of books forbidden by the church. They don't want you to look at this. It was considered a heretical text.
I actually looked up the list. So this is no longer a thing that's like ecclesiastical law.
Okay.
I think they got rid of it in the 60s. The list still exists, and you can go look it up, and you can also see books that were once on there and removed later. And then you kind of see the church's response after they got rid of it, quote unquote. They still said, like, there are dangerous texts out there that can make you, you know, doubt your faith, doubt your morals, etc. But they're leaving it up to the individual to kind of choose what they deem acceptable in the lens of like how they view their faith. But the list is kind of wild. And I was looking at some of the more recent ones. They have like Hobbes on there, like a lot of philosophy stuff is on there.
Yeah.
They're like, don't challenge the church at all. Even though it's like he was like the founder of democracy, essentially.
Oh, wow. John Locke.
Yeah, John Locke is on there.
Yeah.
And then
Machiavelli.
More recently, I was actually
Voltaire.
A lot of them. A lot of anyone who kind of questioned authority in any way or question the church, it was deemed completely
unacceptable. It's a lot of like what we would consider like ancient texts, right?
Right, yeah.
Versus newer texts. Because you would be like, well, isn't the Satanic Bible on there?
Right, yeah, actually, yeah. Because since that was, when was that written?
Satanic Bible.
80s?
Well, Anton LaVey's was, published in 1969.
So this was already, the church had done away with this by then. But then I found one. It was one of the more recent ones was The Last Temptation of Christ, which was like a highly divisive book. But here's the crazy part. That book was later adapted into a movie directed by Martin Scorsese, written by Paul Schrader, who adapted the book into a screenplay. And Scorsese now is known as a devout Catholic. So that's why I was so surprised. I was like, wait, what? He was adapting like a banned book by the Catholic Church? But apparently Scorsese kind of had an era of like secularism, and he had kind of lost his faith a little bit.
Huh.
So he made this movie, which is pretty blasphemous to the Catholic Church.
Wait, what's the movie called?
The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah. A book, I think it was in 1955 translated.
Okay, so this movie came out in 88.
Yeah, and which is crazy because, I mean, this is the same director that went on to make Silence, like a very, very Catholic movie.
For those not familiar, it looks like this, it portrays Jesus in a way that Christians definitely wouldn't like, a sinful man.
Right,
participating in crucifixions. Struggles with various forms of temptation, including fear, doubt, depression, reluctance, and lust.
which I have this sitting on my shelf. I haven't watched it yet. I got the Criterion. Actually, Ian let me borrow it, the Criterion of it. I've been meaning to watch it forever, but yeah, this is, it's kind of surprised me this was on here and made by Martin Scorsese, but
I'm gonna have to check this out.
Yeah. And but, apparently the score is sweet because it's music by Peter Gabriel.
Oh, wow.
He scores the movie. It's awesome.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
William Dafoe's Jesus?
Yeah.
What?
Isn't that sick?
I got to check this out.
Yeah, Harvey Keitel's in there. David Bowie makes an appearance in there. It's a crazy movie. I'm excited to watch it.
Rated R.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
So it's basically if Jesus was just a man.
A human.
Just a human. Not the son of God.
Right. Yeah.
Which, how would he have lived life?
Right. Yeah.
Huh.
But. A little bit of a side tangent there, but I went down the rabbit hole of this Index Librorum Prohibitorum.
Yeah, I got to check out this Greater Key of Solomon too. This looks very interesting to dig into.
Yeah, it's just like a list of demons he vanquished or something like that.
Yeah, I've thinking about like, it'd be interesting to do some episodes just kind of digging into demonology a bit.
The lore of demons.
Yeah, or like the, you know, circles of hell.
Yeah, Dante's Inferno
stuff. Yeah, that would be kind of interesting. I don't know. Hell, what a place. What a place. Kind of interesting. But anyways, back to the Warrens. Let's see how things ended up for the Warrens here. Whether the Borley nun was Valak in disguise is really up to interpretation, right? But the Warrens, while in England in the 70s, encountered a spectral nun during their visit to the Liston Cemetery. They visited Liston after hearing that the bones found at the rectory by Harry Price were buried there, which is interesting. So Harry may have brought the nun over to the Liston Cemetery.
Right, if that's the logic behind
it. If the bones are in fact the human remains of this nun.
Right.
When they got to Liston, it was a cold January night in 1976, and earlier in the day, they had seen glowing stones in the shape of a cross on the cemetery property. And that night around midnight, as they wandered through the cemetery, Lorraine noticed their photographer came to a complete stop. Seeing the photographer stop caused the rest of the group to then stop, and the infamous spectral nun appeared before them. Lorraine came face to face with the nun before the entity vanished into thin air, and no photos were able to be taken. Because everybody was scared. Because you had a photographer with you.
Yeah.
No photos. I mean, I guess there's a chance the nun doesn't show up on the photo.
Yeah. Or according to Ed, he would always make the excuse that the entities know when they're like in a viewfinder or about to be captured on film.
Right.
Yeah. What do you have to say about that, Daniel?
Daniel's like dying over here. Yeah. He's like,
oh, so much. Specifically that, Ed. How do they know what a camera is?
What, do you think ghosts are stupid?
They're keeping up with the times, man.
They gotta stay relevant.
How?
They're overhearing everybody talk about it.
It does kind of compete with the stone tape theory, right? Yeah. Because if it's just this kind of energy that's being replayed, then yeah, they wouldn't have a concept of like photography before.
They wouldn't have a conscience like a modern itself. It'd just be, if it's just a tape and it's being replayed, just, they wouldn't have like, they wouldn't have thoughts.
How would they react to anything?
Yeah, how would they learn? How would they, it seems like Ed says whatever he wants to fit his narrative. Just being honest.
I think that's a bold claim, Dan. No, I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way.
Yeah.
That a lot of the things that they said and did were for self. Yeah, like that was like pumping themselves
for
up.
For a career. You
know? Yeah.
Like even what we were just talking about, how they saw the glowing stones in the shape of a cross. That's not necessary to the story. That's just making it seem like more like something magical.
It's fantastical. Yeah.
It's fantastical.
Like, what? That's you went to a cemetery, there's glowing stones in the form of a cross.
Exactly. Like it's just fantastical. It doesn't seem realistic at all. And
it's good for a story.
Exactly. It's good storytelling. And that's what they did. They sold stories, in my opinion.
Well, why don't
that were adapted into a multi-billion-dollar franchise.
They're really good at it.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Well, Daniel, you know what? Maybe you can just shut up.
You're ruining the paranormal. There are people crying right now.
Okay, look. I want ghosts to be real. I think it's cool. Like, don't get me wrong. When we did our ghost hunt, when I was walking down that hallway alone in the middle of the night and I couldn't hear anybody, It was creepy.
You feel it.
I feel like, oh, someone's watching me. I feel the hair on the back of my neck standing up. I feel it's creepy, and I want it to be real. But Ed and Lorraine are not it. They are not it.
That's fair.
They're not it for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Their personal activities were questionable as well. But yeah, it's hard because when I set out to, when I started the show, I was team Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yeah.
I was like, these guys are the shit. They really did it. And what, 5 years later, I can tell you that I think they are great entertainers. Just like Zach Bagans is a great entertainer.
Right.
Yeah. That does a great job at selling the paranormal. That makes you believe it's all real. Everything he encounters and does is real. But then the more you look at it, the more that you also look at case after case after case after case, you start seeing the patterns and you start seeing the the bullshit coming through. You know, you start seeing it, and it's an unfortunate reality to come to, but it's just the reality. And not to say that I truly believe the paranormal is real. I think there's a lot of unexplained things. There's things that science can't explain. We know that. That's a dead giveaway. But I think when it's packaged in such a way that it leaves no room for mystery and no room for debate.
Yeah, we've explained it all, right. And here it is.
It's so concrete. Like, it was the nun. That's the human remains. Therefore, that's why the haunting's going on there. Yeah. And we moved the bones, and then now the nun's over here.
Yeah, and the evidence that we have is locked away in a secret room somewhere that nobody's ever going to see.
Yeah, you know. And I think also when you actually start talking to and watching real paranormal investigators do their work, and you start hearing like their experiences, and they're like, we rarely come across something that is truly unexplained.
Yeah,
it's very rare. You start realizing like, oh wow, it's far more rare, and it's very difficult to discern what's actually even happening.
Right.
To the point where they just kind of leave it at, we don't know why this happened. There's nothing to point to to say that this caused this. There are no answers. Like,
right,
there really is no way to explain it. Therefore, we leave it at that. It's an unexplained phenomenon.
Yeah. You know? It's almost like the paranormal as a concept being then tied up in a nice, neat bow seems counterintuitive. Like, that seems contradictory in and of itself, because isn't the whole idea of the paranormal is like this inexplicable thing that's happening?
Right.
So when we get the stories where it's like, here is a neat three-act story that's all tied up together, and we have all the answers and the evidence is here. I'm just like, it makes me not want to believe you with something so obscure and a flash in the pan of something crazy happening. I don't know how you can get to the bottom of it like this, and how just the sheer consistency of how much they're coming across these things. Like, we're seeing glowing stones. There are bioluminescent ghost flying up the altars while Lorraine's seeing clairvoyantly seeing like a monk reading
it's
a huge
wild
book.
And not a single photo.
Well, that's the thing about it too, is Ed and Lorraine Warren, I mean, I guess they're, you know, I don't know them personally. I can't vouch for them other than what I know that's been reported, but are they really just this truly gifted couple that just had these insane gifts and abilities to interact with the other side in a way? I think I'm doubtful also because of their religious bias as well, that they always saw everything through the lens of the Catholic Church as opposed to a more unbiased point of view, because I think that's difficult for me too, is when people look through it through one lens or look at it through this is a demon or not a demon. You know what I mean? That, well, how do we even know that demons are real?
Right.
Or that demons are a spawn of Satan? Like, how do we even know any of that is legitimate? We don't.
Yeah.
So that's just one point of view versus like, maybe this is actually something completely unrelated to hell or any sort of afterlife whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it's something, just something unexplained here on Earth,
right,
within our reality, within just this universe.
Like, that's why I was shocked that Lorraine was talking about the materials of the building, because I'm like, that doesn't have any religious foundation behind it.
Right.
I was almost kind of shocked. They never used the word like stone theory or anything.
Yeah.
But I was like, wait, I've never heard the Warrens talk about the material of the building before. And maybe I'm ignorant to that, but we've covered a lot of cases here. I don't ever remember the Warrens specifically talking about material.
Which suggests that they were perhaps open to other ideas and theories.
Yeah.
And see everything through the lens of the Catholic Church, but that's kind of the way that it's presented.
Often the entities are always somehow Catholic.
It was going into locations and determining whether something is demonic or not.
Yeah, right.
It's like, it's either a demon or it's not a demon.
Right.
You know, it's not like, well, maybe it's something unrelated to both.
Right.
Maybe it's not even a human spirit at all. And it's something just unknown. It could be a freaking alien for all we know.
Right. Yeah,
it could be some interdimensional being that's interacting with our reality, just in a different time and space.
Sure.
That we're just not able to compute, right? Like we just don't know.
I like that.
That's how I like to view the paranormal. Is like it's so much more complicated and just
chaotic
than anything. I don't think we have the tools to measure it. I don't think we really understand it in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And our technology hasn't caught up with it either. So I think it's fun to look at it through the lens of sort of the classic telling of a ghost story. And
I'm glad you bring that up, because with all this said, I mean, people have probably hit the...
You're like, you're ruining it for me.
Yeah. But if you come this far, I'm glad you bring that up, because at the end of the day, the reason that we really like covering these stories, I think, at least for me, I can't speak for you, is that we're getting cool stories out of it. These are fun, creepy stories that had sparked some inspiration, some creativity, I think. And even thinking about if, like, let's say it was the Reverend Bull's daughters were the ones that started this whole thing with the nun. Isn't that kind of incredible that over a century of storytelling actually brings in this, like, people see this haunted nun, even if it's completely fake? That is so cool to me that, like, people can tell this story that is then passed by word of mouth to the point where it gets on the world stage, where people are, we're talking about this right now because some bored daughters wanted to, like, think up a nun.
Let's scare mom and dad.
Yeah. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. Well, and like you said, I think for us, it's like that feeling you get when you watch a good horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
That creeped out feeling that you have, that residual dread, as you said, that lingers after you watch, where you're like, you're not quite sure if what you just watched actually exists here in this reality, and you could encounter it for reals afterwards.
Right.
You know, it's that sort of feeling that stays with you to like the next day, and then you're like, oh, that was a good movie, and then you move on with life. But like, it's right after where you're like looking around, you're
checking the dark spots.
Yeah, you're like,
all the lights are off, you have to get upstairs to your bed really fast.
Yeah, you're still a little faster up the stairs.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're like, something could happen in between here and bed.
Yeah.
And that's really what these stories are. And I would challenge anybody who's like, well, you guys haven't heard this one. I would love to see a really well investigated case that has, and we've actually covered a few that had some photographical evidence, some video evidence, things like that. There's not a whole lot of them out there.
Yeah, they're kind of rare.
But
it was like the San Pedro haunting.
The San Pedro
was crazy. That was
I think a viewer or a listener suggested that one, which I want to leave you with this episode, because we're headed into the national month of Lights Out, October. All right. Where every day is a Lights Out episode. Not saying that we're going to put an episode every day. That'd be crazy. And we'd run out of haunted stories, I think. But we want to do some more paranormal / kind of spooky stuff, kind of maybe stay a little bit more away from the true crime part of the show. So if you have any suggestions, we'd love to hear them that are good. Good suggestions.
Good ones,
And please, if you do make a suggestion, do a quick search and just see if we've covered it before.
And see if there's maybe a smidge of legitimacy. Yeah.
See if there's like a few articles on it least before you do. But we'd love some suggestions, because we're gonna do a lot of just some serious paranormal content. Maybe we haven't dabbled in ufology in a while either. Maybe we can jump in that.
I always like those episodes; those are fun,
because there's actually some stuff going around present day right now, which is kind of interesting that I'd love to look into a little bit more. But that is the story of the Borley Rectory, the Borley Parish, and the legend of the nun. Let us know what you think. Do you think, how legitimate do you think this story actually is? I think all of us here are mixed. I think it could go either way, really. It could go, maybe this is all legit. It is very interesting to me that a place like a parish would have this type of haunting going on.
You think they would avoid a place like that a little bit?
Yeah, and that they would know how to solve that problem, right? You know, after all these years, because the claim is that the nun still lingers.
Yeah.
Still seen from time to time. So, well, the nun never leaves us here. We're always greeted by lovely Valak. But yeah, let us know your thoughts on this episode. What do you think? Also, give us any suggestions, and also let us know if you've seen The Last Conjuring. Let us know if we should see it, because we're on the fence about that as well.
I'm not sure.
Reviews aren't looking too hot, which sucks, because I was really hoping that they would just like crush it.
Yeah.
Go out with a bang, end the Conjuring series on a high.
I haven't really liked the movies after the first two. I've kind of struggled through them.
They just feel, I think it's also too, most of us have seen just better stuff.
Yeah.
More hardcore stuff that is just better done, better storylines that were just kind of like, this is kind
of. They look a little basic.
Kiddie shit at this point. It's like teeny bop horror movies.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, good introduction, but maybe. If you don't know.
It is a great intro.
Movies. Yeah.
But then you start watching like actually like legitimate horror movies. You're like, I'm fucked up for days after watching this. Whereas like The Conjuring, you're like, oh, that was a good
that was
spook.
Fun. Yeah, that was fun.
I ate a whole bucket of popcorn during it.
Yeah. You got to see Weapons. I highly recommend everyone see Weapons.
Is that out yet?
Yeah. That's been out for a while.
I'm gonna watch it
tomorrow. I think it's still in theaters. If not, it'll be on like streaming or rental pretty soon. Yeah.
That's good.
That's a good one. And it's actually kind of funny. I got some good laughs.
Love a good laugh.
Yeah.
But that is going to be it for us today. Thank you for being here. If you're still here, really, thank you for listening to us. Sorry if I sounded a little congested through the episode as well. Getting over a little cold, but we'll see you guys next week with another one. Till then, lights out,
everybody.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.